In the late 1960s, Alaska was buzzing with news of a massive oil discovery on the North Slope and the promise of oil wealth flowing into the state. But Prudhoe Bay sits on the edge of the Arctic Ocean, and between that oil and any kind of market were hundreds of miles of frozen tundra and three mountain ranges. Alaska Governor Wally Hickel was impatient to get things moving, so he championed a plan to punch a rough road through the wilderness to connect the new oil field to Fairbanks, 400 miles away. In the winter of 1968, the governor sent a convoy of bulldozers out into the wilderness. But here's the thing. His road never got used. Yeah, in 1974, the oil companies used it for a few short months. A documentary crew from Seattle actually tagged along.
To the men who drive the rigs, it's a toss-up which is worse. The fierce storms of winter or the unrelenting, bone-jarring discomfort of breakup time.
But other than that, it just sat there. A giant scar in the tundra. They called it the Hickel Highway, though it didn't look anything like one. And each spring, when the permafrost thawed, huge sections of the road became muddy, impassable ditches. Critics called it the Hickel Canoe Trail. It's still there today. And in Alaska, much like in the rest of the nation, that's just how it was. Rigorous planning and engineering were optional.
It was sort of the Wild West. It was the old frontier where, whether you were ranchers or miners or whatever, you just went in and did what you want because the land was there. You did whatever you had to do. It was that manifest destiny of the country.
But times were changing, and the Hickel Highway sparked one of the first major protests against oil activity in the state, with conservationists all over the country weighing in. It was a prelude to a brand new battle, one that would reshape how things get built in America and create an era of environmental protection.
Hello, and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state.
On today's episode, how the nation's brand new environmental movement cut its teeth on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Project and the skin of the teeth victory in Congress to get that oil out of Prudhoe Bay.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at ourakspirit.com. With additional support from NPR Story Lab.
Obviously, a governor today couldn't just order a road built across rivers and wetlands.
Yeah, there are laws.
But they didn't exist when Hickel sent those bulldozers barreling across the tundra. Hickel left Alaska to become Secretary of the U.S. Interior Department, and he promised Congress he'd hold the oil companies building the pipeline to the highest standards. But other than that promise, there wasn't much in law to stop Secretary Hickel from granting permission for whatever quality pipeline he saw fit. Attorney Jim Moorman knows, because he tried to stop him.
That's Ginger.
I'm Ginger.
Moorman and Ginger live in an old brick townhouse in the historic Georgetown neighborhood of D.C.
Hi.
He's a tall man with white hair, quite a different look from his bushy-bearded younger years. Moorman was one of the country's first environmental lawyers. In the fall of 1969, the founder of Friends of the Earth asked him if he'd heard about this proposal to build a pipeline across Alaska.
And I had heard about it because I'd read an article about it in the New York Times.
As Moorman recalls it, the pipeline the article described would have been an environmental horror story.
It would melt the permafrost. It would create where there was an uphills and downhills run in slurry. The pipe would lose support and likely break. And the article suggested they had just then moved the pipe to the next valley and it'd all start over again. It was a very alarming article.
Friends of the Earth wanted this project stopped. So Moorman researched the law and he didn't find much. Then, the attorney says, a gift from Capitol Hill.
Shortly after the first of the year in 1970, I learned that Congress had enacted a new law, the National Environmental Policy Act.
These days, every bureaucrat knows the law. You can find it on YouTube.
The National Environmental Policy Act, known as NEPA.
NEPA requires disclosure of the environmental consequences of a proposed project.
NEPA was the first major environmental law in the United States,
and is often called the Magna Carta of environmental law.
Today, NEPA is a big deal. The law requires government to give written notice of any project that would alter the physical landscape. It allows ordinary people the opportunity to influence a project. It's produced massive studies of every corner of the country, and it's been used to stall projects in court. It has completely transformed how America plans and builds and how government interacts with its citizens. But no one, almost no one, saw this coming.
Congress passed NEPA at the end of 1969 with little opposition. Newspapers focused on the historic fact of it, like, now ecology is a national goal. The bill's creation of a White House Council on Environment, that got some attention, but not the nuts and bolts. It almost went unnoticed that the new law required federal agencies to write a, quote, detailed statement for each project it considers. But Jim Moorman, the environmental lawyer, he noticed.
Well, that was a bit of a bombshell for me.
A bombshell. That detailed statement, though, nobody knew what that meant exactly or whether the courts would enforce it. But Moorman's clients, Friends of the Earth, the Wilderness Society, and the Environmental Defense Fund, wanted to stop the pipeline, and they thought this new law could help. So the Alaska pipeline became the first big test, and it helped make the law what it is today. Moorman's clients ultimately lost, of course, but along the way, they would force the oil companies to build a better pipeline. And Moorman proved the hidden bombshell in NEPA packed a punch. In the spring of 1970, oil companies were getting ready to build the road that would run alongside the pipeline, and sections of 48-inch pipe were already on the ground in Alaska. That's when Moorman asked the Interior Department for that detailed statement on the pipeline. He was sure they wouldn't have one. What Moorman got back, the document that was supposed to describe this Trans-Alaska endeavor and list all the environmental effects, was just 8 pages.
8 pages for 800 miles.
I've had this in the files ever since the case.
The document only describes the road, and it even flubs the name of the law.
I'm sorry, I failed to turn on my recorder. Can you read the first couple lines again, please?
All right. The following statement is provided to fulfill the requirement of Section 102.2c of the National Environmental Quality Act. I got it wrong. Is in relation to the special land use permit.
The attorney remembers being nervous when the case went to court. In Alaska, workers were literally unloading pipe in the port of Valdez. But then they won. The judge agreed the government had to consider the impacts for the whole project before allowing work to begin on any of its parts. So Moorman brought the largest project in Alaska history to a halt.
This is a little corny. I had a moment of euphoria. The only other time I've had such a feeling of euphoria is when I got married. And it lasted about 2 weeks. I remember it was sort of like, and in fact, for a moment there, for about 5 minutes, it was like everything had sort of just faded out. It was really quite amazing.
Up in Alaska, a young environmentalist and mountaineer named Art Davidson remembers it as the moment the environmental movement found its power.
So here was something we could grab a hold of and say, well, look, it's not just our feeling that you may be rushing and you may be making mistakes, but, you know, you're required by law to do this.
Davidson was in his early 20s then, working for Friends of the Earth. He was part of a national groundswell of environmentalism, driven in part by a massive oil spill off the coast of California and the dire effects of pesticides like DDT. For a lot of environmentalists, including Davidson, the pipeline and the oil companies were a threat to the last unspoiled part of the country.
I don't trust them to make sound judgments for the environment or for people, local people, along the way. That's not their primary goal.
The environmental lawsuit forced the oil companies to spend 3 more years and a small fortune on engineering, analysis, and documentation. Gone was the idea of putting a hot pipe in frozen ground. Engineers got to work designing elevated sections, insulated sections, sections on sliders so the pipe could flex in an earthquake. In 1971, Senator Ted Stevens took to a Senate TV studio to explain to the folks back home why the pipeline wouldn't be built that year. He said Congress, by passing NEPA, had forced them into a strange new set of procedures.
The final environmental impact statement filed by Interior on the Alaska pipeline must be so complete as to be able to withstand any legal attack brought upon it in the courts.
This was the birth of the encyclopedic environmental impact statement we know today. The government held multi-day public hearings on the pipeline in Anchorage and Washington. Several thousand people testified or submitted comments, most of them against the project. You can practically hear the bureaucracy's head exploding at the work it took just to listen to the public.
Sitting in front of me is a set of transcripts from the Washington hearings.
That's Interior Secretary Jack Horton in 1971 with a stack of paper about 6 inches high.
What you're seeing there is approximately 1/9 of the total paperwork that the department will have to go through very thoroughly.
The final environmental impact statement stretched to 9 volumes. Proponents said no project in American history had ever been so thoroughly scrutinized.
With all 9 volumes in hand, the Interior Department announced in the spring of 1972 it would grant permits. And the environmentalists? They went back to court. It was now clear to pipeline supporters that the lawsuits could drag on for years. And if they wanted an Alaska pipeline any time that decade, Congress would have to act. They had passed NEPA just a couple of years earlier, but with all of that oil in the ground, with steel pipe waiting on the tundra, some lawmakers decided there was no time to let the NEPA challenge play out in court.
At this point in the story, let's meet a second dog named Ginger.
Senator?
Yeah, come on in.
Oh, what's your name?
Ginger. This all your equipment?
Yep.
We interviewed former Alaska U.S. Senator Mike Gravel at his home in California.
Hi, Liz. Mike Gravel.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good.
Gravel is 87 now and the CEO of a marijuana company. He's intensely proud of his work in 1973 to convince Congress to allow the pipeline.
It was the most significant economic decision and a political decision since statehood itself. Nothing compares to it.
He was a Democrat and cast himself as a maverick of the Senate. Senator Ted Stevens used to complain he was a showboat. Alaska's two senators kind of hated each other. Gravel had some drama. Dark hair, bushy eyebrows. He could be a show-off, but he got the job done on this one. And here's how. There were bills to authorize the pipeline in both the House and Senate, but the Senate bill didn't force an end to the NEPA lawsuit. Gravel saw an opportunity. He wrote an amendment that said NEPA's requirements had been met. That would have ended the lawsuit. But Gravel says everyone, even the oil companies, were mad at him. Alaska's current Congressman Don Young says Gravel was trying to steal the victory for himself. Young was in his freshman year back then.
I thought he threatened the pipeline. He didn't care with publicity.
Young and Stevens agreed Congress had to end the NEPA lawsuit. But doing an end run around NEPA, it was very controversial. And the NEPA waiver was quietly advancing in the House bill. Young says Gravel's public showdown in the Senate was reckless because if he lost the vote, that could have killed it, and then there might never have been a Trans-Alaska pipeline. In the end, the Senate vote was dead even. Vice President Spiro Agnew broke the tie. Young doesn't argue with Gravel's success.
He lucked out and became a hero, and God bless him.
But even then, the bill might not have made it to the president's desk if it weren't for world events.
This is NBC Nightly News, Wednesday, October 17th.
Good evening. The Middle East war produced developments all over the world today. The oil-producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon.
The Arab oil embargo. It made an existing fuel shortage worse. And everyone knew what was coming. Long lines at gas stations. With the country in crisis, America decided it really did want Alaska's oil. In Congress, the last opposition to the Alaska pipeline disappeared. The final bill passed with huge margins, and President Richard Nixon signed it into law in November 1973. That cleared the way for construction to begin.
what exactly is the legacy of NEPA? Some see it as a never-ending rabbit hole of regulatory hurdles. This first big test of the law only ended when Congress stepped in.
Today's critics, like Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, say NEPA is a drag on the economy.
Transportation projects require 79 months to complete the National Environmental Policy Act review process, the NEPA review process. 79 months, Mr. President. That's 6.5 years.
Law professor David Ullman says when an environmental review is done efficiently, the delay is clearly worth it.
Because when we do harm to the environment, it's often irreversible.
Ullman says NEPA kicked off a decade of environmental lawmaking. It produced the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And it wasn't just for the trees and lakes. Ullman says the laws made people healthier. Ullman says the revolution started with NEPA.
It was extraordinary at the time because there were no obligations for the federal government to consider the harmful ecological effects of government activity.
Maybe the Trans-Alaska Pipeline would have been well engineered anyway, but NEPA forced the oil companies and the government to prove it.
When the oil companies finally got the okay from Congress to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, Alaskans had been waiting for years to see something come out of Prudhoe Bay.
Next time on Midnight Oil, how Big Oil built the largest privately funded construction project in the world in 26 months and brought the 49th state along for the ride of its life.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Midnight Oil. Our story was edited by Annie Feit and Jennifer Pemberton and mixed by Dave Waldron. James Glaves composed our music. Our media producer is Eric Keto.
In addition to the voices in this episode, thanks to all those who told us their stories to help us understand this history, including Jack Ferguson, Jack Heshen, Guy Martin, and Malcolm and Cindy Roberts. I'm Liz Ruskin.
And I'm Rasha McChesney.